Today, we're going to get personal in Psalm 109.
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
The superscript for this psalm, Psalm 109, is to the choir master, a psalm of David. This is, as all psalms, a messianic psalm. So there's no doubt in this one because it's referred to explicitly in the New Testament in the context of what happens to the Messiah having been betrayed by Judas. We'll make reference to a couple of New Testament passages in light of this psalm, at least illustratively. One of them is direct, but the other just illustratively. The point is, it's a messianic psalm, as all psalms would be. And so in the mouth of our Messiah, we realize the truth of this psalm first. And then, because we are in him, because we are his community, we realize the truth of these words in us as well. So all of that's the case. So it's messianic, and it turns the direction of our needs toward the glory of God and his name and his holiness and his expectations of righteousness. So it is a very impersonal psalm. I don't mean it in the harsh way. In one sense, because it's drawing all the attention in the right direction, where it should be, away from us. And yet the psalm remains very personal to the one who is uttering the words. And that includes us when we're able to kneel before God and repeat, rehearse these prayers, these songs of his people, back up to his ears, we're able to pray these things about ourselves personally. And so in a way that it's not as ironic as it is a deliberate structure in the psalm that we can follow directly, but in a way that is, it creates a little bit of misdirection. This psalm remains very personal. And so we're going to get personal in Psalm 109, as I will discuss. So starting in the first section, there are only a handful of sections, so we'll go through this fairly quickly, and the middle of the psalm, the request, the part you would expect to be the middle of most prayers, is the longest by far, verses 6 through 25. That's the request in a 31-verse psalm, right? So the whole heart of this thing is about asking for something specific. It's actually two specific things. And that section of the psalm is arranged so that we go into it in one way and come out of it in the same way and sort of meet in the middle. So the whole psalm has this structure to it that invites us to consider something, worth talking about personally. So here's the thing. What prompts the psalm in this case is in the first five verses where David says this, because it says, again, it's a psalm of David. So in the first five verses, it goes like this. Be not silent, O God of my praise, for wicked and deceitful mouths are opened against me, speaking against me with lying tongues. They encircle me with words of hate and attack me without cause. In return for my love, they accuse me, but I give myself to prayer. So they reward me evil for good and hatred for my love. As you know, you read through it, you can put a lot of people into a context where we see them praying this psalm. I first think of Stephen, you know, standing literally surrounded by people chewing on him with their teeth, meaning, you know, metaphorically, they're saying blasphemous things against Stephen. And Stephen, you know, a very messianic figure, a very Christ-like figure, just like in Jerusalem, is, you know, a reminder that this is what happened to Christ, that they surrounded him and they condemned him with their words, and then they actually murdered him in the same way they actually murder Stephen. And so, you know, we put it in the mouth of the Messiah right from the beginning. But the point is, these things are also true for us to be able to pray, so that we think of ourselves as being in the Messiah and not being the only ones who've ever suffered. We're in Christ and suffering. And so we offer it up to God, knowing that he hears us as well. So be not silent, because all of these terrible things are happening to me, verses 2 through 5. Notice, though, that the way it's worded is clearly about the contrast between God being silent while everyone else is making plenty of noise. So all my enemies, they're out here screaming against me. I can hear their voices. I can see their anger. And you, up in heaven, God, you're just silent. You're not doing anything. Why is that? And so I'm not saying it's a doubting prayer. I'm not saying there's cynicism in it. But I am saying the opening to this prayer, contrasting God's silence with the very outspoken nature of the adversaries to the psalmist, is, you know, the dilemma of faith. It's where we see this contrast every single day in the world. It's the dilemma of faith, because we believe in a God who hates evil and is powerful enough to stop it, and yet everywhere in the world there is evil that is not stopped. And so, you know, here's God being silent in whatever form you would put that. We're just putting it in words right now. Here's God being silent, and yet the world making plenty of noise against the very things we know that he stands for. Why is that? And so in this psalm, it is, God, you're silent. Don't be that way, because the wicked and deceitful mouths, they're opened against me. They're speaking against me with lying tongues. You know the truth, but you're not saying anything. They speak only lies, and they're speaking them all of the time. Okay, that's the setting for the prayer that's about to be offered. And so I refer to it as the prompt. The prompt for the prayer is very personal. I'm experiencing in the world the contrast between what I know should be true in a world ruled by an omnipotent God who hates evil, and the world I actually see, which is a world filled with the hate my omnipotent God ought to be stopping. So whatever's causing that, I have a reason for turning to God and saying, please don't be silent anymore, O God of my praise. He's not being cynical. He's not being hateful toward God. But he is pleading for God to act, to do something. Now, I want to, because of where this psalm goes, I wouldn't do all of this just from the first five verses, but obviously I've worked through the rest of the psalm as well. And because of where it goes, I just want to point out an aspect of this that's worth hanging on to as we go through the rest of it. Recently, I read through again A Grief Observed. Read it ages ago and hadn't read it in a while. It's a very brief book, journaling sort of thing that C.S. Lewis did on the death of his wife, you know, Joy Davidson, I think was her name. And you can, you know, it's a very transparent book of a person working through their suffering and their faith at the same time. And, you know, those who've read it know it's a legitimate work. It's worth considering. So anyway, having read through that, I know, and everybody who's read through it knows, what he's going through is what anybody with sincere faith and sincere loss has gone through at some point. It always happens. He just records it, you know, in an intelligent, thoughtful, insightful sort of way, with the ability to write in a way that very few people have. And so, you know, it sort of applies to every process of grief that we go through. And it's something like this fact that we know intellectually what it means for there to be evil in the world and for there to be a God who could do something about it and isn't. And I'm not saying he doesn't do anything about it. And I'm a Christian. So I'm not saying he's never done the thing about it. He obviously has. He sent his own son into the world to confront it for us and to be in that suffering on our behalf, and then just invites us to join with him in participating in that suffering until he makes all things right. I understand. And that's exactly what I mean. Intellectually, I understand, just like any believer who's thought through it understands at some level what it means that evil hasn't been stopped in the world, that God isn't doing everything he could in order to stop the evil in the world, or it just wouldn't be here because he's omnipotent. He can do anything. So we know intellectually that this is the case. We're prepared intellectually. God is omnipotent, and God has done things, and yet there is evil in the world. And this is all part of, you know, Augustinian freedom or whatever. I can give all the different answers. We know it intellectually, and then it comes to our lives. We heard about it down the street. People were knocking on the door. We heard the sirens. We heard all of that. That's all fine. And then it knocked on our door, and it came inside, and it took our father, or it took another person that we cared about, or it began to touch us personally with our health or decline or whatever it is. And suddenly, we panic, we flee, but most importantly, in some sense, we grieve. And in that grief, at times, react in a way that makes us cynical or dubious, at least, of the faith that we have held. So we begin to doubt. And critically, it's easy for us to look at that. And I've said this before. And to a certain extent, it's true. It's just not the end of the matter. Critically, we can look at that where it seems hypocritical that everyone else's pain, I've said it this way to us, you know, for all of our lives, we know there are people dying everywhere in the world every single day. There are people starving in the world every single day. People lose their jobs every single day. We know about all the evil through all the history of the world, and we believed in God just fine until our dog died. And I'm not just saying it's about our dog. I mean about serious grief, but that can be serious grief too. Whatever it is that made it personal, it's at that moment that we suddenly doubt. I don't know. I don't know if my faith is real. And we can be critical about it like I'm implying right now. You know, how hypocritical can you be? Everyone else's pain seems just fine to you, doesn't make you question your faith. But when it strikes us personally, that's when we truly begin to doubt. That seems selfish. That personal nature of this kind of grief, that it has to be personal before it really gets to that level with me. But I think it's more than that. And I think this psalm helps demonstrate that. In just a moment, I'll point that out. I think this is what's true in my mind when I've gone through that process, the death of my father. When you go through the process of just saying how I can understand why people doubt, I understand where this comes from. I think when all of that's going on, when it's personal like that, it's really more than just, now it matters to me, so I guess I am mad at God after all. I think actually it's our only real first opportunity to grasp just how immense the suffering of others is also. And I don't just mean by that suddenly I become empathetic, but I mean by that I think sometimes I find myself in that personal moment standing in the room, this giant empty room that I realize is not empty, that's filled with other people who are suffering at a level that I didn't realize they were suffering at. And that whole vacuum of enormity is what creates this sense that God is too silent. Something's off here. It needs to be fixed. And I'm not saying we stay there. And again, I'm not a cynic about it. I'm not a skeptic at all. But that sentiment, it's literally communicated in these psalms over and over again. I think God expects us that if we don't ever have a moment of crisis, we must not be taking seriously the contrast between the way the world ought to be and the way it is. The contrast between the power of the God we're supposed to have faith in and the things that he's actually demonstrating in the world we live in. I think we're not understanding it if it doesn't bother us. So I think, you know, what's happening in us is that when we experience that personally, We're not just saying, I'm suffering, but I'm now in this place where this kind of pain seems inevitable. That in this moment now, I can actually understand what it is that's going on. So in those first five verses, all I'm trying to point out right now is, in those first five verses, there is a motivation laid down for the request that's about to come, and it's just personal. Don't be silent, God. All these terrible people are cursing me out loud. Why aren't you saying something in response to them, you see? So they reward me evil for good, and hatred for my love. They're against me. Why don't you say something? So the prompt is very personal. Now comes the request, which is left at the personal level because we don't have any other reason for it to be asked right now. So as the request is made, all we can know is that David is praying it. He's offering it to us as an example prayer. When we're in the Messiah, we can pray this along with him because of the suffering we're experiencing. My enemies are standing against me. Speak out, God. In fact, God, curse my enemies, because the first half of the request is an imprecation. It's a curse. Appoint, starting in verse 6, a wicked man against him. Let an accuser stand at his right hand. When he's tried, let him come forth guilty. Let his prayer be counted as sin. May his days be few. May another take his office. You hear the New Testament in that verse, right? In Acts 1. May his children be fatherless and his wife a widow. These are the kinds of harsh prayers that you would expect in a Greek tragedy, you know? May his children wander about and beg, seeking food from afar, from the ruins they inhabit. May the creditor seize all that he has. May strangers plunder the fruits of his toil. Let there be none to extend kindness to him, nor any to pity his fatherless children. This is harsh, in case you didn't notice. May his posterity be cut off. May his children suffer because of what he did. That's this prayer, this curse. May his posterity be cut off. May his name be blotted out in the second generation. May the iniquity of his fathers be remembered before the Lord. And let not the sin of his mother be blotted out. Let them be before the Lord continually, the sins of his father and his mother. Let them be before the Lord continually, that he may cut off the memory of them from the earth. It is as harsh a judgment as you could possibly ask for. And right now, it's all grounded in the fact that these people are just standing up and cursing, and I'm not saying this is unimportant, this chosen one of God, that they're cursing the Messiah or the child of God. So make his grandchildren suffer? You know, what is going on? What's going on is that we are then invited into a different justification for the curse, starting in verse 16, going through verse 20. So the imprecation has been made. God, you know, curse these people in this way. But now something not personal. Starting in verse 16, the justification for the curse comes in the form of their unrighteousness, not what they've been doing to me, but just who they are. So in verse 16, because he did not remember to show kindness, but pursued the poor and needy and the brokenhearted to put them to death. And in the messianic note, obviously you pause here to realize in the Messiah's prayer, in Christ's prayer, those are the same thing. He surrounded me and cursed me. Jesus isn't here because he needed something. Jesus doesn't show up in any village because he's hoping to strike a deal with somebody or create a following for some movement. Jesus is here because the needy need him. All of us are needy, if you don't get the point. Jesus is here because of the poor and the needy and the brokenhearted. So when they surround Jesus, they're surrounding the poor and the needy and the brokenhearted. So for Jesus, this prayer is one and the same, whether he's offering it about those who are surrounding him and accusing him, or he's offering it because those wicked people did not remember to show kindness, but pursued the poor and the needy and the brokenhearted to put them to death. And Jesus has become the poor and the needy and the brokenhearted in so many different ways. one just by entering the world, but the other by taking their needs upon him, and the other by recognizing their need and caring more about them than he cares about himself in every way. This applies to the Messiah on both ends of this imprecation. But as he says it starting in verse 16, he's making it clear that it's their unrighteousness that merits the curse, that merits the judgment. This wicked person did not remember to show kindness, that's verse 16, but pursued the poor and the needy and the brokenhearted to put them to death. In verse 17, he loved to curse. Let curses come upon him. He did not delight in blessing. May it be far from him, the blessing. He didn't delight in blessing, so may blessing be far from him. He clothed himself with cursing as his coat. May it soak into his body like water, like oil into his bones. So he didn't care at all about blessings. He didn't offer any blessings. So, okay, let him be far from blessings. He wants curses? Oh, he's cursing. He's throwing them out everywhere. Well, then let those curses soak into his own body like water, like oil. Let it soak into his bones. This is very much the Proverbs, right? A man rolls a stone and the stone rolls back on him. That's the whole idea. And it's the equality, the equity that's built into God's judgment and God's righteousness, just like I've mentioned in previous occasions about Revelation 16, the prayer of all the saints and the angel that comes down and pours out the wrath of God on the earth, and the springs of, they're turned into blood. All of that judgment comes because the people are finally receiving what they deserve. They poured out the blood of the saints. They can drink the blood that's in these waters, the blood of the saints. So they're going to drink that very same blood. A person gets exactly what they have, and that's the whole point, that what they deserve, that is. That's the whole point here. This person cursed, so they're going to receive curses. That's completely different than this person is cursing me, so would you please curse them? This is, hey, may the things that they're pronouncing just come back on them. That's what we desire. Verse 19, may it be like these curses, may it be like a garment that wraps around him, like a belt that he puts on every day. And that's the point. He's girding himself up with curses. So here, guess where you're going to be? Girded up with curses. In psychological terms, and the Bible is not a psychological book, I'm not pretending that, but if we were to convert this to the psychological language of today, to the way we think of the world, then it would be the point I try to make with people when they share with me some bit of bitterness, some anger or something like that, some angst that they have. And I, you know, it depends on the person. I'm not always blunt and direct, although I'm getting a side-eyed look from my producer, from Daisy, right now. Maybe I am. I don't mean to be. But the point is, maybe I do mean to be. I don't know. The point is, I wouldn't say these words to every person that does it. But I have said in broader contexts what I think is practically, universally true. That if a person tells me they're bitter because of this or that, you know, it's look at what happened with whatever, the elections, or look at what happened with education, or look at what's happened with my family life, or look at what happened to me personally, or at my work, or you know, whatever it is that made them bitter. If a person shares with me that they're bitter about this or that, all I know about them is that they're bitter. I don't really know anything about the context. Their view of the context isn't what's going to inform me about the reality of the world. What I do know is that they're bitter. And in psychological terms, that I'm saying that would be in describing it psychologically. It's just your psychological state. This is the demeanor that you choose to take in response to it. I don't mean by that we're not provoked in that direction one way or another at different times. But I do mean by it. When we take up that demeanor, the person it affects, the person who's wearing the belt, is us. When we curse, or when we become bitter, or when our cynicism, or whatever it is the position that we land in, we're the ones wearing its belt. That's it. And so here, may it be like a garment that he wraps around him, like a belt that he puts on every day. The implication being he's putting it on every day. So let him wear it. He put on the curses that he was pronouncing. Let him wear those curses. May this be the reward of my accusers from Yahweh, from the Lord. of those who speak evil against my life. This is, and you know, what's interesting about verses 16 through 20 is that they are the emphatic part of the text. There is it's not just in Hebrew poetry, but it is certainly true in Hebrew poetry. And, what do I know of Hebrew poetry except the Psalms? But those are the ones I'm talking about and care about. So in the Psalms, things are done in couplets. It's just how things are arranged. And so you have all of these beautiful parallelisms where you say something and it's said twice. And in each statement, you have a slightly clearer understanding of what's going on. So tons of couplets in Scripture. And then there are these unique verses that are in triplets, where you have three phrases instead of two. And in the elongation of that phrase, in the hesitating on it, pausing on it, repeating something one extra time, making it a triplet instead of a couplet, you provide emphasis for the text. It's a natural poetic device. And it's true from that point forward. It's certainly true in English literature as well. So you can notice when a poet might be wanting the listener, and you don't even have to recognize, it doesn't matter whether you're counting rhythms or not, just the fact that you spend some extra time on that line, that there's something different about it. It's like putting up a flag and saying, pay attention to this. So in this passage, where every verse, verses 16 through 20, they're all triplets except for verse 19. But even that makes sense. It doesn't matter. 19 doesn't change it. But even that makes sense, because then that verse becomes particularly important. You know, may it be like a garment he wraps around him, like a belt that he puts on every day. But it's 3, 3, 3, 2, and 3 in a psalm that all the rest of it, except for the very next verse that I'm going to mention, verse 21, they're all in couplets and then these triplets. So they are begging for us to infer that this justification, which now he's explaining, why should you curse this person? And he doesn't say, because my feelings are really hurt. He threw sticks and stones at me and broke my bones. He doesn't say that. He says, here's the reason for it. He didn't show kindness to the poor and the needy. And he lived his life cursing others. So all I'm praying for is for you to demonstrate your justice, O God. You are almighty. They are worthy. That's the language out of Revelation 16 that I mentioned a moment ago in the prayer for judgment that comes in that passage. And so here, because he puts all these in triplets, we're given room to infer that the justification about God's righteousness takes priority over the impetus that caused us to offer the prayer to begin with. What turned me to God was personal. Can you see what's happening here to me? But then what grounds our request for God to do something about it is God's desire for righteousness to be in the world. So the grounding is about justice, and it justifies not just the request being made now, because we understood the request being made in the personal impetus, but it justifies the request being answered. And that changes a lot. If God's just going around settling our personal scores against our enemies, that's different than God making things right in a world that is not showing itself right just now. And so through verse 20, this prayer for imprecation, we've taken the psalm from a very personal note, even in the mouth of the Messiah, but in our mouth, certainly, a very personal note, hey, these people are cursing me, would you curse them, to one that is about God's righteousness being realized in the world. Then we pick it up again. Oh, and in fact, let me just pause here for a second and remind us, because I had mentioned above that in the imprecation that he's requesting, that he asks for, he makes it clear that somebody else should take his place. Let someone else have his office, is the way that we say it. May another take his office, in the ESV translation. I think in the Old King James, in the New Testament part of it, it says, let another take his bishopric, right? His authority or his position of authority. That's obviously about Judas. So in the New Testament, we know that they took this as a messianic psalm, because when they're talking about Jesus having died at the hands of Judas, or a Judas's betrayal, they have to replace him as an apostle because he's now dead. And so they stand up. Peter stands up with the brothers. I'm taking Acts 1:15 and following. stands up with the other disciples, and says, brothers, the scripture has to be fulfilled. The Holy Spirit spoke beforehand by the mouth of David concerning Judas, who became a guide to those who arrested Jesus, because he was numbered among those, was numbered among us and was allotted his share in this ministry. So he was part of us, and yet he betrayed us. He betrayed Jesus. Now, this man acquired a field, and the description, this is the parenthetical note that Luke makes about how Judas died. And then he picks up again in verse 20, so that's about the field of blood, and says, because it is written in the book of the Psalms, may his camp become desolate and let there be no one to dwell in it. And, quoting this psalm, that one was from Psalm 69, this psalm, let another take his office. So as they looked at Judas betraying Jesus, they said, that's what's happened here. Judas fulfilled what's written in Psalm 109, and so now he has faced the curse of Psalm 109. He's wearing as a garment wrapped around him the death that he brought onto our Messiah. He's the one who's facing the eternal nature of this curse. So not only did they take the psalm as messianic, but they understood the justification for this curse as being about someone who had violated the very basic evidence of God's righteousness being in the world, which was Jesus himself being in the world. And so it's fulfilled in his judgment. Okay, keeping that in mind, because I'll come back and mention one other thing about that in just a moment, we pick up in verse 21 with the second half of the request. So remember, we had the impetus, you know, the thing that first introduces the desire for anything at all in the adversaries surrounding David and God being silent. And then he starts the request with an imprecation. So judge them because they've not lived up to your righteousness. So he grounds it less personally, more in God's righteousness. And then he says, and also let me ask you for this, God. So in verse 21, but you, O God, my Lord, deal on my behalf for your name's sake, because your steadfast love is good, deliver me. So he's staying in the middle of the motivation that has to do with God's name and righteousness, and in particular in this case, God's chesed, God's steadfast love. So because of that, but deliver me, respond to my need. So not only curse my enemy, but now help me, rush in and rescue me. And again, while it sounds personal and selfish for a moment, we have needs and we ask for help. That's what we do. So I'll come back and talk about that in just a second. So in verse 21, you include the higher grounding, the Lord's name, his steadfast love, his hesed, in the plea for help. And so in verse 22 through 25, you have that impetus for seeking help being brought up again, which is about the person who's asking for the help. So while we're coming out of the curse and then the justification for the curse being in the righteousness of God, we stay in that righteousness of God talking about his name's sake and his steadfast love, and then we say, but I still personally need help, and so would you help me? And so in verse 22, because I am poor and needy, and my heart is stricken within me. I'm like a shadow at evening, which all of that imagery is really beautiful, isn't it? Powerful imagery. I'm gone like a shadow at evening. The shadow, the darkness is getting longer and longer and longer, and then eventually it just fades away into nothing. That's me. That's what's happening to me right now. You can identify with that if you've been through these times. So he says, I'm gone like a shadow at evening. I'm shaken off like you would shake off a locust. My knees are weak through fasting. My body has become gaunt with no fat. I am an object of scorn to my accusers. When they see me, they wag their heads. So it starts out personal, and that's in the reason that he's making any of these requests at all in the psalm I'm talking about, and then turns to justice and then God's name and the hesed, but then comes back to being personal. So before I get to the end of this psalm, which is the last four verses here, verses 27 to 31, I guess the last five verses, before I start on the end part of the psalm, I just want to make the point that this is sort of where we live, and it's a beautiful place to understand the contrast that we have in the world between the evidence of evil that we see in the world and our desire personally, but also corporately, to see God exercise his power, do what he can do to stop that evil. And so I'll just put it in the context of holidays. You know, all of us go through this. I'm not going to tell any great stories about it. Just want to make the point that, you know, when we're children, we love the holidays because of the personal benefit. That's what matters to us as children. And it's not evil. Nobody looks at a six-year-old child and says, "You wicked little thing, why would you want to receive these gifts? I'm going to throw them in the fireplace. You don't deserve them." It's not selfishness. I mean, it is. They are being about themselves in that moment. But it's not wickedness. It's just they're immature. They're children. They want to do stuff because they, for the same reason we want them to do it, for the same reason we go buy the gifts and put wrapping paper on it and make a big deal out of opening them and all that kind of stuff, because we do care about them and we do want them to have joy. And so we want them to seek that joy. So it's not a huge surprise that children would love holidays. Obviously, I'm thinking of Christmas when I say it, but it's about all the other holidays too, the special meal or the playtime with their friends or not having to go to school or the special stories that we're getting at night from our parents or whatever it is. They love it for the personal benefit. How else would they think? They're children. As we become adults, hopefully at some point, if we become adults, I guess I could say in the current day and age, we learn that there's something more important than that. That there is, you know, and there are all kinds of things that are more important that we can fill in the blank with here in the illustration. The community of our faith, the fact that we get to go and experience these things that are so transcendent, we have to have special experiences, a liturgy, a repetition, a favorite place, a location, a song that we sing that identifies with that particular moment, whatever it is, in order to just remind us of this transcendence that has miraculously somehow intervened in our world. And it can be that, and the community that we get to have with these people as we stand around and sing these songs, or even just the community that we have with family, even family that we're only going to see that one time during the year and that we're going to make jokes about the rest of the year. The fact that we sit down with them and experience something unique and different is what an adult looks to, or just to the attachment of something greater, a purpose that we have that goes beyond the mundane drudgery of daily life and so on. I'm not saying our lives are pure drudgery or something, but you know, you get the point, that there's some moment where we pause and say, ah, there's something more. It's why we celebrate on Sunday, the resurrection, every single Sunday, the resurrection of Jesus. Or if you were Jewish, why every Saturday you had a Sabbath where you paused to remember that all those day-to-day routines were created by a God who had enough purpose in it to set one day aside so we would remember that it's his world for his purpose and so on. Those are the kinds of things we start to remember as adults. But even as adults, here we are, we're adults. And so, oh man, the community of faith, oh, isn't it great? We're going to be able to spend time with family. Oh, I love remembering that we're a part of something bigger, part of a tradition that goes back for millennia, whatever it is. We're saying all these adult things, and it's still really nice to eat some great turkey or to get those socks you've been craving for so many years. The part of us that's a child isn't wicked because it's a child. The part of us that's personal isn't wicked because it's personal. We can begin to worship that. We can begin to live in that and ignore what we should have become. So a child never grows up, or a selfish person never looks beyond himself. But what we have to do is recognize that it's not wrong to have that personal reality going on in our lives. When we remember, the more eternal, the more significant, the greater, the other, the reason that we exist in the world, it wouldn't be a surprising or a terrible thing for us to return to the reality that we're also happy that we get to talk to that God who came into the world and intervened on behalf of righteousness. That's not a bad thing. And that's what this psalm does. Here's my personal impetus for offering the prayer to you, God. Look at these adversaries and then curse them, but do it because these people are, they're unrighteous. They're not showing what you want in the world. And God, because your name is so great and your mercy is so great, would you also remember to help me? I need help here. And so it becomes personal again. And it's not wicked in the personal nature of it, because it still is about demonstrating. And that's how this psalm ends, by returning us to remember, to understand of that, you know, moving from the personal impetus back to the divine or the higher grounding that's in our relationship with God. And that even in that, when our personal need has been met, when that part of us that's selfish is satisfied by the fact that God has done something to help us, that even in that moment we remember, that gives us the opportunity to lift him up, to give thanks to him. Why are we giving him thanks? Because it did something I saw in my own life that was benefited. And I need to tell other people about this. And that's how the psalm ends, with this. So in accord with chesed, with the steadfast love of God that he mentioned to us above in verse 21, he says in verse 26 now, "Help me, O Lord my God, save me according to your steadfast love." So the prayer for help that concludes this section of asking for help is a reminder that it's still surrounded by God's steadfast love. And now this introduction into the close, where he repeats the curse, the adversary's, you know, curse that is returning on the adversary, but then also turns it to praise as he thinks about what it means for him personally. So in verse 27, "Let them know that this is your hand. You, O Lord, have done it. Let them curse, but you will bless. They arise and they are put to shame, but your servant will be glad." And notice in this that there is a desire for the other to curse and then for God to be able to bless the person who cursed. There is that. And in many parts of Scripture, that's what we talk about. It's the repentance of Saul, you know. We rejoice in that. Those testimonies are unbelievably powerful and beautiful, and Jesus does it constantly. And he tells us to do it. Turn the other cheek. That's telling us to love our enemies is asking a curse to be turned into a blessing. We want that. But in this verse, what he's doing is saying, let them curse, but you bless. And he's making the point that in them cursing, they're wrapping up their own judgment. But in God blessing, he's wrapping up his servants and protecting them. So let them curse, but you will bless. They arise and are put to shame, but your servant will be glad. May my accusers be clothed with dishonor. May they be wrapped in their own shame as in a cloak. That's down through verse 29. You know, all of that is reminiscent, and I'll keep this short because just the amount of time we've had. But that's reminiscent of Jesus in Luke 22 when he's being confronted by the crowd that Judas leads to him, by the people who are going to arrest him, not just a mob, but by the soldiers and so on, who are going to come and arrest him. And as he's speaking to them, and Judas comes, and he's betrayed with a kiss. Again, this is the Judas who's named earlier in the psalm, or implicitly named earlier in the psalm, as the one whose office would need to be taken. As Judas comes and brings the curse, remember, Peter raises up his sword to strike back. They're fighting. We'll fight back. No, we put it in God's hands, and Jesus tells him, no more of this. Stop that. I'm doing this part from Luke. And then Jesus says to the people who've come, who are pronouncing the curse against him, we're going to arrest you. We're going to take you. Which one of you is Jesus? We're taking you. And Jesus says, really, have you come out against me as if against a robber? You know, you're bringing swords and clubs to fight against me? When I was with you day after day in the temple, you didn't lay hands on me. But this is your hour. This is the power of darkness. That your hour and the power of darkness reference is a reminder of the very same thing that's in this psalm right now. Yeah, maybe it looks like God is silent and all the adversaries are the only voices that can be heard. But in the end, Peter, you can put up your sword. God won't be silent. He will clothe those who are bringing the curses in their own curses. And so so he goes on into verses 30 and 31 to make the point of what comes out of the mouth of the chosen one, which means comes out of our mouth because we're in the chosen one, and that's praise to show God's faithfulness. So where we started out saying, God, would you speak? These people are cursing. Where we end up is in the psalm is saying, I'm going to speak because I know you will take care of the curses and you will take care of me. And so it's my mouth that's going to speak your praises in this world. So in verse 30, with my mouth, because again, remember verse 1, don't be silent, God. My enemies are speaking. So in verse 30, when we get to the end of the psalm, and God has shown how he's going to do all of this, we open our mouths. With my mouth, I will give great thanks to the Lord. I will praise him in the midst of the throng, for he stands at the right hand of the needy one to save him from those who condemn his own soul to death. And again, it's in that statement to Peter, put up your sword back into its place. I mean, you know, for all who take the sword, they'll perish by the sword. Do you think I can't appeal to my Father and he will at once send me more than 12 legions of angels? The whole point here is that Jesus is saying to Peter, look, if God wanted to stop this, he would stop it. There's a reason for God to stop it. Jesus is about to be crucified. Peter and the disciples are about to be thrown into even more tumult. Why not stop it? God is all powerful. Why isn't he speaking now? And Peter's response is to say, let's speak on his behalf. Jesus' reminder to Peter is to say, you know, God has something in mind beyond our personal need. And that's what he's accomplishing. That reminder is, you know, where a lot of times in my own ministry, in my own life, that's where I've stopped. Well, God has something more that he's doing. I think it's the way we read the book of Job a lot of times. And I did this through the whole book of Job. We've talked about it. This psalm certainly makes this point. We just read the whole book and think, well, God's doing something bigger, so I guess it's just okay for Job to suffer. You know, it's just worth it. God is doing something more than our personal suffering, or it wouldn't happen. And Jesus points that out in the moment of his arrest to Peter. Don't you think I could call on my Father and he could send 12 legions of angels and they would deliver us? You think I need your sword? God knows what he's doing. I'm not concerned about that. And yet, while all of that is true, there is something beyond our personal suffering that would make it right if God just said, look, I need to use you in a way that's going to hurt and you're not going to like it, but I need to do this for something more important than you. Wouldn't we have a reason to accept that and to say, you are more important than me, so do whatever you need to do, even if I never see the fruit of it, if I never know the result of it? I think it's what Paul's spirit is saying. I could wish myself accursed for my brethren, my kinsmen, according to the flesh, as he prays for Israel. I think it's what Jesus is saying in the garden. Nevertheless, not my will, but yours be done. And yet, with all of that said, and all of that being true, this psalm makes it clear that it never stays there. While all of that is true, he, a God who could do all of that, completely neglecting us personally and be justified in it because he created us. We're just dust. He remembers that when we're sinning and he's kind to us. Why wouldn't we expect him to remember it when we're griping about how much better we want things to be in the world? Shut up, you little piece of dust. He could. He just doesn't. While all of this is true about how much greater he is and his purpose is, he still remembers us. He still regards us. He includes our concern in the prayer he gives to us to offer to him so that we will remember his name and his goodness when we face our problems. Problems even he remembers.
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.